Okay, good afternoon, and perhaps we'll get underway. Welcome to the annual tenure information session for the downtown campus. This session is intended for any and all tenure track faculty members and for administrators who may be involved in the process at the departmental or faculty level. And you may be a tenure track academic staff member who is coming up for tenure in the next cohort or at some future date. The meeting is open to anyone and everyone who may have an involvement either now or in the future. You will see that we are recording the session, and it will be posted for future reference on the McGill website. That may take a few days or even a week before it is there. But if you hear things during the session and you want to refer back, or if you have colleagues and you'd like to refer them to the session because they're unable to be here today, that it is a valuable information source. My name is Stephen Stropel, and I'm the Secretary General of the University. And you may well ask, you know, what role does the Secretary General have in the tenure process? And so I'll just take a brief minute to explain that the Office of Secretariat helps in three ways in the tenure process. One, it coordinates the process, and generally, from our point of view, at least, the process begins in May, around the beginning of May in any year, and it continues through until the end of May, sometimes into June the following year for each particular tenure cohort. And there are a lot of deadlines and a lot of steps, a lot of process, a lot of regulations to be complied with along the way, and we help with that process. Secondly, we compile and manage most of the documentation that is involved, and as you will hear in today's session, there's significant documentation at various points in the process, and most of that is managed by the Secretariat. And thirdly, there are a great deal of communications that take place during the process, both for you as individuals going through it, and also between the Secretariat and departmental tenure committees, university tenure committees, external examiners, and so on. And again, we handle a lot of those communications, not all of them, but a lot of communications that are vital to the process right through from beginning to end. Today's presentation will consist of four presentations, four speakers. First, our principal, Professor Suzanne Fortier, followed by our provost, Professor Anthony Massey, and they will provide an overview and a high-level conceptual framework of the tenure process. Then our associate provost, Policy, Procedures, and Equity, Professor Lydia White, will take you through the regulations relating to the employment of tenured track staff, to explain the various parts of the regulations that have a significant bearing on the tenure process. And finally, our Director of Teaching and Learning Services, Professor Laura Weiner, will speak to you about the preparation of your teaching portfolio, which is a significant part of the overall tenure dossier. I will remind you of two things that may or may not get mentioned later in the presentations. The first is that the timetable for the tenure process is outlined in this little yellow brochure, which is available at the table at the back if you didn't receive one on the way in. And the specific dates may change from year to year, but generally this outline reflects the normal process that you will go through regardless of which year you're considered for tenure. And the other thing is just to remind you that the tenure dossiers are now submitted in electronic format, and so it's something to begin to think about in terms of preparing for the submission of your dossier, is to provide all the materials in electronic format. And we realize that in some cases, for example, if you have a published monograph, that may not be readily available in electronic format. So it's not a hard and fast kind of rule, but generally the portfolio should be submitted in electronic format because it's circulated to multiple individuals along the way, including people external to the university, and this is just the most efficient way of distributing the documentation to the individuals who will be involved in the process. I just remind you as well, again, for your own information if you're interested, but also for colleagues who may want another opportunity to attend the tenure information session. There will be a session held on the McDonnell campus sometime in January, most likely toward the end of January in 2015, and a notice of that session will be circulated to the university community in the not-too-distant future. And one other introduction that I would like to make right up front is the person in Secretariat who is responsible for most of the work and with whom you will be interacting and working with during the year in which you're considered for tenure, and that's Bonnie Bornstein. So it's a name that you should become familiar with. You'll receive a number of communications from her as you're coming up for consideration for tenure. So without further delay, I would like to welcome and introduce our principal, Professor Suzanne Fortier, who will say a few words about the importance of tenure in the academy.
Okay. Merci. Bonjour et bienvenue à cette session sur le processus de permanence à McGill. It's great that you're able to join us today on this session on tenure, which I'm sure is very important to you, but I must say it's also very important for McGill, for the university. I think you all know, I don't need to tell you, that great universities depend first and foremost on the quality of their academic and research environment, and processes such as tenure, promotions, and so on, are meant to ensure that we keep in our university the very highest level of quality that we can achieve. I think you know that throughout, in particular, the last decade, and in periods where we face financial constraints, we nevertheless engage in a very robust and vigorous renewal of our academic environment at McGill. Many new people were hired. I think Tony will probably give some statistics, but I think I might be correct in saying that over the last 10 years, over half of the people were new hires. And what is great about McGill is that hiring is not limited to hiring within our country, but really recruits worldwide, and McGill is able to attract very, very good people from all over the world. As I said, this is important, and in fact, it is important to maintaining the very good academic environment that we have here. Very high standards are expected of all of us, and a particular very high standard when it comes to the teaching responsibilities and to research, as well as service to the community. And of course, as you know, as part of the tenure process, all three elements will be looked at, and you'll have a chance to build your dossier and present your achievements in all three very, very important areas of your responsibilities in your work here at McGill. And I want to stress, because often people will think that, well, research is more important, research and scholarship. Certainly something that has impressed me since I've arrived here is the attention that is being paid here to the quality of teaching, both at the undergraduate and the graduate level. And I think this is one of the qualities that make McGill what it is, and it is very, very important. And I would like to thank you for also committing to these levels of excellence in all three areas of your responsibility. As I'm sure you know, and as I know you will hear throughout this session, tenure is a very important process, an important element in keeping high-quality environments in universities. Tenure is part of what preserves and protects academic excellence and, of course, also academic freedom. Tenure allows us sometimes to go expand knowledge and do research way outside our current frontiers of knowledge, explore new areas that may be challenging common assumption, and it is important that we have principles such as academic freedom that allows us to do that. But I think a very important thing is always to remember that there are two principles here that go hand in hand. In isolation, they would not be able to preserve the very good environment that we have here, and that's academic excellence and academic freedom. So I know you're embarking in this process. This is at the very beginning here. It may look a bit daunting because you'll have to prepare lots of material and go through several, I guess we can call them hurdles. They might feel anyway like hurdles. But I encourage you to think about this as a way to look at what you've accomplished and think about what you want to do next and what you want to do in the future, because you're going to take stock of all that you've done, all you've accomplished in your first years at McGill, and it will give you a chance to think about what you want to do and what you want to explore next. And I think that is the exciting part about the tenure process. So I encourage you to look at that as well, not just the very significant amount of work that you'll have to do as part of the process, but also the great thinking that it will stimulate, and the thinking about how you see your career evolving at McGill. So make the most of it, because it will really help you shape what you want to do and sharpen your sense of your own goals and your own aspirations and how you can make them happen. There are a lot of people, as you know, who are here to help you in the process, certainly the provost and several people in the office of the provost or associated with the office of the provost, and of course the secretariat. So do not hesitate to seek help when you need it, because they're there to assist you in this important process. So I'll stop here. I wish you a productive journey through that process. And as you know, in the agenda now, you'll have some very important information that will be shared with you from the provost and also from the associate provost, as well as from the director of teaching and learning services. So hope that you'll benefit from this session. Et merci beaucoup d'être ici avec nous aujourd'hui.
Thank you, and welcome to the session. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Tony Massey, the Provost of McGill, and the Office of the Provost is tasked with assessing the tenure dossiers that come forward from departments and faculties and making a final determination as to whether or not the recommendation will be made to the Board of Governors. But one of the things that we are now doing earlier with most of the cohorts is presenting the rationale and the privileges and responsibilities of tenure early. We're doing that at the sessions when we bring people in for orientation. But some of you are in a cohort where we didn't do that. And so I want to just take a couple of minutes to go over things that are more theoretical than practical, but they should help you also to orient the way in which you write your statements, the way in which you think about the process of what tenure really is and why it is so important to universities. Tenure is supposed to embody fair and proper procedures for the evaluation of academic staff on the three criteria that the principal mentioned. It's research, teaching, and service. Those are the three basic academic duties, and they go into the assessment at McGill for all people who come up for tenure. Everyone is expected to make a contribution to knowledge through their publications and research. Everyone is expected to instruct students or supervise graduate students to completion, and to provide some level of service to the communities that they are part of. And that could be your own department, the university, the profession, or even the outside community if it's relevant to the assessment of your tenure dossier. So we really want to make sure that you understand that those three things are the foundation for which tenure is awarded. Now, it might sound strange that the very next thing I'm going to say is that about the termination of someone's tenure, but it's really important to get this right, because once we invest in an individual at a university to give them tenure, if we put it in stark financial terms, which we shouldn't always do, but I'll do it for a moment, it's a $4.5 to $5 million investment over the course of your life. It's your salary for life. And that's a large commitment for a university to make in terms of investing in you to allow you to pursue what is your passion for generating and disseminating new knowledge and being of use to the community. But when you have tenure, it's very difficult to have it taken away. And so when we make a tenure decision, we have to keep that in mind. This is a decision for a lifetime. This is looking after only a very short number of years at a candidate and trying to make an assessment as to whether or not that person over the course of her or his life is going to be an asset to the university, to the profession, to the discipline they're from, and to society. So it's a big decision. The only way you can lose tenure is for cause. And that there are causes for which you could lose your tenure. Failure to continue to produce research, scholarship, and or teaching can be a cause, but it has to be a very big cause, right? Something that we can say you're no longer meeting your academic duties. Or there could be external reasons why a conviction for a major crime that forces you not to be able to perform your academic duties. We don't have leaves of absence for jail terms. So you have to think about what cause would be. But even then, we have to follow really careful and fair, proper procedures. And that's why the Secretary General is involved. Secretary General's office is not part of the academic apparatus of the university, but it is the guarantor of the impartiality of the process. And so we always want to think about that. There have to be clear expectations set out. There have to be rules and regulations that you're all aware of and that have been promulgated to you, and a clear path forward. And these sessions are meant to help you in this year you're preparing your tenure dossiers to understand what you have to do and how you have to do it. The last thing is, in very narrowly circumscribed situations, if there were a bona fide financial exigency, tenure could be broken. That would be a very rare circumstance. I've never seen it used in Canada, although it has been used in the United States. And that would mean that there's just no one who you can teach. There's no money to pay your salary. The university would have to be in very dire straits, and we're not there. Notwithstanding what you've heard in the newspapers, don't believe it. So I want to just focus for a minute on what a great privilege tenure really is. The principal noted that it is based on the importance of academic freedom. And that freedom extends from your research to your teaching and also to the service you provide to the community. It is a real privilege, and it's a privilege that's not extended to most other occupations or professions. It is also meant, tenure is meant to give you the right to pursue your lines of inquiry and research and teaching, but it's also meant to provide you with a certain degree of economic security. That means your salary, right? It's covered. It also means that once you get tenure, you're going to be asked to participate in this important decision for others. So you will be playing an important role in the life and decision-making of the university, and you can expect that the university's obligation to you is to put you in a circumstance in which you can fulfill your academic mission, the three duties. And that doesn't mean we're going to support your research. It means we're going to put you in a position to be able to apply for funding external to the university to get that research. It doesn't mean you'll get to teach only when you want and only what you want. There are collegial decisions and resource constraints that may determine your teaching schedule. And it won't tell you which committees on which you serve, but there'll be an expectation that you will serve the university in some way. But along with those privileges come responsibilities. The most important thing is that in every aspect, the individual must behave in a professional way. So professionalism is very important to the assessment of tenure and continuation of tenure. You have to teach your students, supervised graduate students. You can't decide that teaching is not what I really want to do, I just want to do my research. You have to actually engage in teaching. And when you do your scholarship, your research, or other contributions, there is a trade-off there. Everything that you do we expect will enhance you as a professional, will improve your performance as a professor, as a researcher. That's an investment in you professionally. On the other side of that is the responsibility that that enhancement of your professional, or the development of you as a professional, will enhance the university. So there's a relationship between us. The university invests in individuals, and the individuals then contribute to the reputation and reach of the university. At McGill, our regulations relating to the employment of tenure-track academic staff, and also those related to employment of librarian staff, have a very clear recognition that once you get tenure, as the principal said, it's the start of a new journey. It's not the end. And a member of the academic staff who is granted tenure shall maintain the high standards for which it was granted. And that's an expectation we have once you've gotten tenure until the $5 million is exhausted, right? So we want you to make sure that you maintain those standards so you don't fall below. Just when you get tenure, don't have a dip off in our expectations of your performance. We're investing in your future. Based on the performance you've shown us over the last 4 or 5 years. The tenure process is extremely important, but it can only work if there are sound evaluations of tenure-track faculty. And that starts from the before you come or in the first weeks that you're here. You have to know what the expectations are for tenure, and I'm sure that your departmental chairs or your dean has indicated the importance of contributions to research, teaching, and service. The contributions to research will vary by department. They'll vary by discipline. But your obligation is to be in, our obligation is to inform you of them, and your obligation is to take them seriously. It also means that if we have sound evaluations of our candidates from the time they're appointed at the university or reappointed, it means that the outcome of the tenure decision can be defended. And that's important. It's not a capricious thing. You give people tenure on the basis of a fair process that adjudicates the content of their dossiers. And it's not only the case that you should be compared to people who came before you. I tell all chairs and deans, My expectation is the people who we are hiring now have exceeded the expectations that we had when we went through tenure. It might not sound fair to you, but it is the only way the institution can continue to advance. We ratchet up expectations. I'm never disappointed, by the way, when I see the applications that the candidates that deans bring to me for being appointed at McGill. In my 10 years as the provost, I've seen this steady increase in the qualities of the individuals who've come to our university. But it does mean that the tenure process has to be one that's based on a constructive dialogue. So you can have a dialogue with your chair or with your dean about your performance, and that performance assessment is done every year through our merit process. There is a dialogue about how well you're performing. It's also important that department tenure committees, the DTCs, are asked by my office and by the deans not to pass up the latter difficult decisions based on difficult conversations and colleagues. The best decisions are generally taken at the local level. And so departmental tenure committees have to make difficult judgments. The university tenure committee, chaired normally by a dean, also then compares across different units within the same faculty and has members of other faculties who sit on it to get a university perspective. And then the final analysis, the final administrative aspect to this, is an adjudication by the principal and the provost with regard to the recommendations coming forward from a DTC and a UTC. And if they're in conflict, that creates a very difficult situation, right? So, but they can be, and they are. And Lydia may talk a little bit about that. But just to make sure that the processes and procedures are fair, at all levels, if a negative decision is being reached, the candidate can appear, and then there can be, if it's a negative decision by the principal and the provost, it can be appealed to a committee. These granting tenure is the most important decision that we make at McGill. McGill is composed of its professors. Its professors give it reputation through their research and publications, through the training and education of students, and therefore the decision to take someone on as a tenured professor is the most important decision we make. These tenure decisions define the character of the university and the character of our libraries. So we really want to make sure that they're the right decisions. You define, the professoriate and the librarians define the university. And so we ask some questions that we reflect on them in terms of the criteria. When we're looking at a tenure dossier, and it's your obligation as tenure candidates to make the best case you possibly can. And there you're going to ask yourself, does your individual performance meet the criteria that have been established by your department, the faculty or library, and the university on all three dimensions of academic duties? You can assess that yourselves, right? And we have people during the course of their time as an assistant professor without tenure who come to a different decision than the one that you're facing, which is submitting your application. Some people leave ahead of time. They simply recognize that they can't meet the criteria, or they don't want to, or they take another opportunity. The second question we ask is the kind of work that the individual is engaged in, this is the DTC and the UTC we'll ask, is this work representative of the high standards that McGill University holds itself to? Does it have international reach and reputation? Is it in the most important venues for the discipline under consideration? Does it have impact in terms of the citations and other examples of it being used? And the final one is more qualitative, and that has to do with, will this tenure decision be good for the department, the faculty, library, or the university? We know, in general, a positive tenure decision is good for the individual. It gives you security, it gives you an opportunity. But is it also a good decision for the institution? Is it the proper fit? Have you met the criteria? Are they up to our standards? And will it be a good decision? So those are the kinds of things that go into the assessment of this dossier that you're now being expected to prepare. your research statements, your teaching philosophy, and your contributions. The preparation of your CVs is really important. It's up to you to make sure they're easy to read and clear, and that your statements really reflect in the best possible way who you are and what you want to do. So I'll stop there and take any questions if you have them. I used to get that kind of silence when I taught statistics, but I'll take that as a positive. Okay, thank you very much. What's that? Oh, there was a question. Sorry. Well, I have to say that when I first took the job as provost at McGill, one of the most disconcerting things I ever heard from a candidate who was being denied tenure was that's the first they'd ever heard that their performance wasn't good. So we've tried to correct that. So when you get to the university, in fact, within, I think Lydia will talk about, within 60 days of being appointed, of taking your appointment, you should get a note from your chair indicating that there are certain expectations for your reappointment and tenure, and these are going to be, these expectations have to be met. And then every year we have a merit exercise at McGill that it consists of a performance dialogue. You get a merit raise. The raise itself is not important. It's the dialogue that leads into it that gives you some indications of how well you're performing. So are you doing well on research? Are you doing well on your teaching? Have you been serving the department? Service is the most difficult for assistant professors ever to get excellent on, because you've got only so many hours in a day and weeks in a year to be able to meet your teaching and research expectations. So service is important, and we don't expect you to shirk it, but it's a harder one to assess. But your chair should give you indications about your performance on a yearly basis. And when you're renewed, that's after 2 years of service and then into your third year, the chair will write you a letter, the dean will write you a letter, and I will write you a letter indicating that you are meeting or not the expectations, that congratulations, your research grants are great, your publications are wonderful, but you know, you have to show up more for classes or something, right? We'll give you both the positive and negative in a written way so you know that you should be moving on those other dimensions. So yes, we give indications. Thank you. Lydia is now. Another question.
The service to the community, is the balance to which you weigh the service to McGill versus service external to McGill the same? Or is.
I think the service component is very variable across disciplines and with individuals. So the service to the university could come, and for assistant professors, they're most likely to be more involved in their own departmental work, but or with their own discipline. So the balance doesn't matter. It's that you've demonstrated that you have a sense of service to the community, and you've demonstrated that by serving on committees, being on refereeing journal articles for your discipline, being part of organizing a conference, or doing something that is a contribution that's not directly related to your own research and scholarship, but is helping the community. We don't take university service more importantly than departmental service, especially not for assistant professors. But it is not that easy to arrive at an adjudication that says the service is X is superior. It's there. It can happen. But it's not the teaching and research are the two dimensions on which people generally in the early parts of their careers excel. And then as they learn more about the university, they're drawn more into university service, or as their reputation is enhanced, they're drawn into service to their discipline. Any other questions? Thank you.
So my name is Lydia White. Apart from being Associate Provost, I'm in the Linguistics Department. And what I'm going to do now is walk you through some of the relevant aspects of the policies that relate to tenure and the procedures that you'll be going through if you're up for tenure in the next year, that you'll be going through fairly soon or later if you're not yet at that stage. So one thing I'd like to draw your attention to is that we have, for those of you in the room, two sets of regulations that are relevant. They've already been mentioned. The regulations relating to the employment of tenure track and tenured academic staff and the regulations relating to the employment of librarian staff. I would strongly encourage you to look at these regulations. For the tenure track staff, it's Section 7 that's most will be of most concern to you. And for the librarians, I think it's Section 3. Don't take it for granted that, I think it's easier for you if you understand what all the steps are, and I'm not going to go through all of them today. So just to remind you, when must you come up for tenure? So your mandatory year depends on whether you were whether you are an assistant professor, an associate professor, or a full professor without tenure. And for most of you, I'm assuming, are assistant professors or librarians. So your mandatory year is in your sixth year of your appointment, calculated from the calendar year of your first appointment. But there is also the option of early tenure consideration, so before the sixth year if you're at the assistant level. Those of you that think you might be candidates for early tenure should have a conversation with your chair, or your chair may have a conversation with you. There are also circumstances in which your tenure consideration can be delayed beyond the sixth year if you're an assistant professor or librarian. So if you've had an authorized leave, such as parental leave, leave of absence, short-term disability, that has lasted longer than 3 months, you can, in fact, elect to exclude that period as a period of service for tenure consideration. And if you do that, it has the effect of putting you into the next year's tenure cohort. If you are in those circumstances, you must be sure to inform the provost's office not later than the 1st of June of the year you'd normally be up for tenure. And just to remind you that only two such extensions are permitted in total, including any leaves taken before reappointment. You are reviewed by a number of different levels. So a number of different committees will be considering your dossiers, first of all at the departmental level, and note that all committee members who are assessing you must be tenured. So your departmental tenure committee, DTC, chaired usually by your department chair and four other members of the department. UTC, the university level committee, which is chaired by the dean and has five other members. I'll talk about them later. And then the principal or the principal's delegate, namely the provost, will also be assessing your files. If you're in a joint appointment situation, then both departments are involved in the process. And if you are in two different faculties, then both faculties are involved in the process. So what are the criteria for tenure? They're based on your performance of your academic duties. These have already been alluded to, and I'll go over them in a bit more detail in a moment. And as the provost already mentioned, you should have, within 2 months of having been appointed to tenure track, receive from your department the criteria that your department is expecting for reappointment and for tenure. So what are these criteria or academic duties? For those of you that are professors, note that the academic duties are assigned by your chair, although I will make a slight caveat to that in a moment, but it's your chair who determines what you're going to teach. So undergraduate and graduate courses, for example. Now, supervision of students is an important part of teaching, not necessarily assigned by your chair, since in most units, graduate students will approach professors to ask them to supervise. The second component, research, here it's not the case that your chair is going to tell you what you have to do your research on. That's not the intention. But research is a major component of your dossier. And then, now I noticed that I think both the principal and the provost use the term service, and we all call it service, but you'll see if you do read the regulations, the word service does not occur. Its service is referred to as other contributions to the university and the scholarly communities. So for librarians, the academic duties overlap but are somewhat different. The main academic duty is position responsibilities, then professional and scholarly activities, which may include research, and then other contributions, i.e. service. So everyone looking at you for tenure consideration will be focusing on your performance of your academic duties, and certain standards are required. So for those of you, for all of you, you have to obtain a rating of superior in two of the categories and then at least reasonable in the third category. But in the case of librarians, one of the categories is named as requiring superior, namely the category of position responsibilities. Very important to bear in mind that by the time you're being considered for tenure, it's your performance that's being looked at. It's no longer your promise. At the level of reappointment, we take promise very much into consideration, but tenure is about your performance. So looking back over the previous, usually 4 or 5 years. And the period being considered is all the years up to the year of tenure consideration, you know, with the exception of any years that you were on some kind of leave. Your performance at McGill is what we're interested in, unless you are an early tenure candidate, in which case you can also bring in considerations of your performance before you came to McGill. We look at the whole record, so all the years that you've been here and all academic duties over those years. And then two things to bear in mind. The first one I've called no overflow from one category to another. Supposing that you are able to demonstrate that you are not just superior in research but truly outstanding, but let's say your service is borderline, you can't sort of take the fact that you're doing fantastically well in research and allow it to compensate for not doing well in one of the other categories. You have to meet, you know, two superiors and one reasonable, and you can't kind of move your superiority about, so to speak. And the other thing is no double counting of achievement. So one of the things I think that people don't always appreciate is that there will be some choices that you make as to what category to put certain academic duties in. So is supervision of graduate students teaching, or is it research? Some people put it in one, some people put it in the other. Is doing grant reviewing, reviewing for academic journals, is that service or is it research? So for some academic duties, you will have to make a decision about which category to put them in, and you can't put the same duties into two categories. So if you've decided that, and probably the most sensible decision is that graduate student supervision belongs in teaching, you can't also put graduate student supervision of the same students in your research. So you have to make a decision. And to some extent, you can be strategic about this, like, oh, my teaching looks slightly weaker than my research, or my service looks slightly weaker than... If it's a duty that could fit into more than one category, put it into the category where it's needed, where it will help. And if you're not sure, talk to somebody. Where should I put this? Don't put everything into one category and, as I say, build it up so that it's more than superior and it's leaving your other categories behind. And don't double count. So what do you need to do? Well, it is your tenure, so you must, as the regulations say, exercise due diligence. So, you know, establish in your dossier that you've met the requirements for tenure and put the dossier together. And very important, don't leave the dossier till the last minute. Do not leave it till the summer before it's due. It's due on September the 1st. You can be doing a lot of work on your dossier in advance. Laura Weiner will tell you some things that you can do as far as the teaching part of the dossier is concerned. The thing that I would say is especially think about your CV. Keep it updated all the time. Don't wait till the summer before tenure to try and remember what talks you gave, what committees you sat on. Keep it constantly updated. It will really save you a lot of trouble. So what goes into the dossier? Well, the CV. You have to provide a personal statement which kind of outlines your performance of your academic duties. So it is providing, and then you can have appendices that kind of back up what you've said in your personal statement. So you're going to include a record of your research, and I'm saying this year, I think, for the first time. Make sure that in your record of research, you append examples of your publications. We had several candidates this year who forgot to include publications in their tenure dossiers, which seems very strange because your committees need to see your publications, and above all, the external evaluators are evaluating you on the basis of your publication. So make sure that your record of research, you know, includes information like your grants and so on, but definitely including publications. Your record of teaching, and as I said before, Laura Weiner will talk about this a bit more, about how to present how you've done your teaching. And then you need to talk about your service. There may also be other material that you would like to submit and you can include. Now, things get added to the dossier. So September the 1st is the date by which you are responsible for your part of the dossier. It has to be submitted to the Secretariat. But after September the 1st, reports from external evaluators will be added by the Secretariat. I'll talk about the externals a bit more in a moment. Your DTC chair can add items before November the 15th, and if so, you will be copied. And you can add items before November the 15th. Typically, what candidates will add between September the 1st and November 15th is information that something that they had, say, an article they had submitted to a journal has been accepted, or a research grant has been granted. That's the kind of material you should definitely be adding if you can. And then, after November the 15th, any of your committees can request you to add more material to clarify some issue that has arisen while they're deliberating. And let me say that if you get news that a paper has been published, accepted for publication only after November 15th, go to your DTC chair and sort of ask them to ask you to add it to your dossier, because they do need to know this, and we've got this funny November 15th date, but you should be able to let them know when positive things have happened but missed the deadline. So the external evaluators, they are providing an evaluation of your research and scholarship, not your teaching, and only your service if you've got very obvious service to the professional community that, for example, conference organizing, sitting on certain committees and so on. So they're going to mostly focus on your research. They have to be recognized experts in your field. They must not be at McGill, and they must not be in any kind of conflict of interest with you. So let me just run through the timetable. I think we can see this as consisting of three phases. And the first phase is sort of the summer before you deposit your dossier. So before May 1st, you and your chair will have drawn up a list of 8 external evaluators, in fact, a ranked list we're now asking for. And the chair will forward this list to the dean. And also by June 1st, if you have had a leave and you want to defer tenure consideration, you must do so by this date. Let me make it clear, you don't have to defer tenure consideration. This is your choice. So many people choose to defer, and many people choose not to defer. And only you can assess whether you need that extra year. And then by June the 30th, your UTC will have ranked the list of externals, and that allows the secretariat to start getting in touch with them to see if they are willing and able to assess your dossiers. So by September the 1st, I've said this already several times, your dossier is due. Your dossier, the Secretary General has mentioned, is due electronically. We talk about an internal and an external package. The external package goes to the externals and consists of, well, everything really except the teaching component of your dossier. So the second phase is after you've submitted your dossier, and you can sort of sit back at this point unless you get asked for extra material. Now it's going to be the work of the DTC in phase two. And I've already mentioned November the 15th as a point at which, up to which material can be added. The DTC will only receive the external letters towards the end of November, but most DTCs will start meeting before that. After all, they don't need the external letters to consider your teaching, or maybe not your service either. So most DTCs will be meeting more than once, possibly before they get the external letters and then afterwards. And then, in fact, the DTC must submit its report by January the 25th, and that report goes to the UTC, and the UTC meets over the winter term. And it's not just the DTC that might ask you for extra information. The UTC might do so as well. So you might be asked, even in the winter term, could you please give us X in order to... for us to understand your dossier a bit better. And then the early summer, the UTC submits its report not later than April 30th, and in May and June, the principal or the provost acting for the principal will make the final decision and a recommendation to the board. If the principal or the provost attending to the negative, you will be told this in May, and I'm going to talk about what that means or what the implications are in a moment. But before we get to that, so clearly the DTC and UTC must be guided by objectivity, impartiality, fairness. They're making their recommendations on the basis of how you've performed your academic duties. And they are assessing that on the basis of your dossier. So what is the material in front of the committee. And the committees will provide reasons, not just reasons for the next committee, but reasons that you will also have access to justify their assessment of how you've done in each area. So there is this issue of, it's possible that a committee will tend to what's called tend to a negative at some point in the process. This is actually true for reappointment or tenure, but we're just talking about tenure here. If this happens, you will be advised in writing that your committee is tending to the negative. You will be given their written reasons for why they are concerned. And you will be given the substance, but not the names and no identification, of the external evaluators, what they said about you. You'll be given time to prepare a response, and you'll be given an opportunity to appear before the committee or the provost in person. And important, you are allowed to appear together with an advisor who is a member of the university community. So if you are not recommended for tenure, your appointment will in fact continue for up to one year, and you have the option of filing an appeal. I think the provost already mentioned that. So let me reassure you that most of you will not be facing a tending to the negative situation. And also, and this is very important, if this happens to you, don't throw up your hands and give up. You'd be surprised how many people, of the few who face the tending to the negative, appear before the committee and persuade the committee by providing extra evidence, extra material, extra insight, that in fact the committee should not make a negative recommendation. So it is well worth taking up the opportunity to meet with the committee and speak to them about your dossier. And by the way, the committee will tell you what it is about your dossier that you're concerned about. So if they've told you that you are superior in teaching and service, but less than reasonable in research, spend all your time convincing them that research should come up to a reasonable, or whatever combination. Don't waste time telling them about how great you are on something where they've already agreed that you are great. So if you are granted tenure, as most of you will be, you will be appointed to an indefinite term as an associate professor starting on June 1st of the year, at the end of your year of tenure consideration. So who to ask? If you need help in interpreting the regulations, feel free to get in touch with me. If you have questions about the timing of tenure, certain aspects of the timing, contact the Academic Personnel Office, and tenure submission deadlines, procedures, and so on, contact the Secretariat. I have also prepared, a year or so ago, a list of frequently asked questions on tenure, because it turns out people are sending me the same email questions year after year. And you might want to take a look at, by the way, these slides will be posted. You don't need to write down the links. But you might want to take a look at the kinds of things that people have asked in the past. You may find it helpful, or I hope you'll find my answers helpful. Okay, so just to conclude, the process may seem to be intimidating. Don't allow yourselves to be intimidated. Plan ahead. This really is the best advice I think that one can give. And don't be afraid to ask other people for advice. Probably ask more than one person. Don't just ask a colleague who's just gone through the tenure process. You know, ask your chair, ask a more senior professor, ask one of us. And above all, don't wait till the last minute to put your tenure dossier together. Work on it now if you haven't already started. Start now. Don't wait till the summer. So that's it. I will take questions. Yes.
Sometimes if you come from another country and you're starting your life here as an NGO, and it takes some time for the research really to pick up. And sometimes it's like that last year or the year before, that's when things really start to happen. How is that seen by the committee, and how to really address that?
So the question, I've been asked to repeat the questions because of the recording. The question is, how to, particularly for people coming from other places, but actually I think it affects Canadians as well, what to do if you have only really got up to speed in the last year or so before tenure, maybe because of problems setting up your lab or just adjusting to life at McGill and so on. I think the important thing in your dossier, and the provost may want to add something, but in the research component of your dossier, show how you were building up a research program, that it's your research, not somebody else's research, and show how, although you maybe don't have much in the way of publication to show in early years, you can show a trajectory which happens to have come to fruition in the last couple of years. So build it up, talk about the positive aspects of it, the publications that you've got and so on. And if there are genuinely circumstances beyond your control to do with setting up the lab, be frank about that. I mean, don't hide it. Many committees will recognize that there can be a difficulty at the beginning of your research career, but don't use it as an excuse. Use it as, it's part of the way, it's part of the build-up. Don't rely on that to get you tenure, but also don't hide it under the carpet. Do you want to?
Over a number of years, the cohorts of tenured track professors include up to 60% who aren't from Canada. So it's not that's a generally accepted excuse, because we're an international university and we bring people here from all over the world. It's important, as Lydia said, that if there are individual problems associated with establishing your research program, platform, or agenda, then those should be part of your dossier, and the crescendo effect can have an impact. But the assessment, as Lydia pointed out at the very beginning of her presentation, the assessment of a tenure dossier is on delivered goods. It's on performance, not the promise that if your lab gets set up. If it's not getting set up appropriately, if you're having trouble early on, those should be brought to the attention of your chair and dean, and they can be brought to our attention as well. In my 10 years as the provost, only once, and that's over now, I guess it's close to 1,000 hires we've had. Only once did we think that the lab didn't get set up and it was the fault of the university and we had to give an extension. That's very rare. So, but it's your obligation to make your entire case known.
Actually, for some reason, we don't say unreasonable, we say less than reasonable. So the official terms are superior, reasonable, and less than reasonable. So you're aiming for two superior, well, actually, a good number of each cohort get three superiors, at least half. So although the provost said it's hard to get superior in service, there are many people who do get superior in service. But those are the technical terms, yes. Yeah.
You mentioned that there has to be two superiors and one reasonable. My understanding is also that research has to be only two superiors, and I'm not sure that came.
Well, okay, so... It wasn't on the slides because that is not the case according to the regulations. The regulations say two superior and one reasonable.
However, you're right in your intuition that we strongly prefer dossiers which have superior in research and teaching. But we've had tenure candidates. It's not very common, but we have had people who've got tenure in each year's cohort. There'll probably be at least one person who got tenure where the research was reasonable and the other two were superior. Don't rely on this. Aim for superior in research and teaching. But the regulations are neutral. They're not neutral for the librarians, but they're neutral for the professoriate. Yes. Okay, so the question is about the role of the externals and also how they're chosen. The role of the external evaluators is really to help the DTC and the UTC in their decision making by providing or shedding light using their expertise on how you are perceived in the research community, you know, outside of McGill. And their role is very important because many of you will be in a situation where the DTC members and or the UTC members won't be experts in your subfield. So to move on to your second question, so it's important to choose externals who do have a very good sense and probably are themselves people whose research is in your subfield so that they can really give informed assessment. The second part of your question, do you just give your chair a list? Well, I would suggest that you come up with a list. This list will be discussed with your chair, and your chair, in my department, we sometimes discuss the list in the department as a whole so that, you know, various people can say that person is unsuitable, that person is in a conflict of interest or whatever. But it is ultimately you and the chair together that are going to put forward a list. But obviously, in many cases, for many of you, you will be the best person to assess who are the right externals. But don't choose people you think are going to be soft. I mean, the UTC ranks the list, and they will be looking at things like what is the stature of the university that the person is in. You are actually going to give reasons why you've chosen an external. So what's the stature of their university? If it's a university that one might call second rate, you need to say the department that that person is in, or that person is the world's expert despite the fact that they're in some...
exclusions. You can't have people you work with.
Yes, and the other thing is, of course, you can't have people that you've worked with or worked with... So you've got to be careful that this would fall into the conflict of interest side of things. And for those of you in very small fields, we know this can be a problem. It's okay to put people that you've met at conferences. That doesn't count as working with them. But you have got to be, you've got to, and if in doubt, so both the Secretariat and I, in April, we get lots of emails saying, here's a scenario, am I in a conflict of interest? And then we'll give you advice, and in fact, on my frequently asked questions, I've got lots of examples of should you put this person in, should you not? Yeah. Other questions? Yes.
They're also regarding external reviewers. Do they need to be international, national, local? Do they need to be full professor at the universities and so forth? Are there more clear guidelines?
Right. There aren't. It is a good thing, though, to have some international. And I think especially not, I mean, there's no harm in having, you know, one or two local, but don't to have nothing but local.
Local
to Montreal. Not local to McGill at all. Local to Montreal, maybe, but you want to show a good distribution, because remember, one of the things you're trying to establish that you have got already got an international reputation in your research, so get some internationals. Do they have to be full professors? No, but I think they should have tenure themselves. We've had some cases in the past where it turned out that externals didn't have tenure, and this is not. However, there are some countries and some universities where they don't have a tenure system, so tenure or tenure equivalent status, but not assistant professors who have not themselves gone through tenure. Yeah.
So does it exclude then, perhaps in the fields like medicine and engineering, where the industry aspect could actually, industrialists would say this is very good research applicable to our field, so these people are essentially now they have to be university professors?
Yeah, so the question is whether people in industry who are not university professors can act as externals. And the answer, I think, is it depends. So if you could show that an individual was, in fact, the equivalent of a research scientist or a senior research scientist, that would be okay. But if they are a captain of industry, that would probably not be okay, because the assessment is of your research and not so much of the potential of the research to have applications beyond the field. That reminds me. If you are doing research or working on something that might have innovative possibilities or entrepreneurial possibilities, never mind the letters issue, this is something you can think about. Is this research, or shall I put this in the service component of my dossier? Because it could go in either. But the letters really need to be people who can speak to the research component of the dossier. Yeah, I think I saw another hand. Yes. That's a good question. The question is about how much to include for early tenure. I'll just give you my rule of thumb, which doesn't yet answer your question, because people ask, how far back can I go? And my rule of thumb is go as far back as would give you 5 years, because you are in your sixth year for normal tenure consideration, so go back. But your question is an interesting one. Can you pick and choose, so to speak, and decide, I just want to include my previous research and not my previous teaching? And I've never had this question before, because I think most early tenure candidates include everything. I don't know how to answer the question. The thing is, if you include the research and don't include the teaching, is this going to make your committee think, why is there no prior teaching? It might be one of the things they'll then say to you, we need more information. So on the whole, I would say if you're going to go back, you should probably do it across all three areas. Do you agree?
Also about the contacts. You don't want them contacting the people who are on the list.
So going back to the previous question, yes. Yeah, so going back to the previous question, you may not have contact with the external referees. This is done entirely by the secretariat. But for the early tenure, I would suggest you include all three areas of academic duties. Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, it's pretty high. Like the cohort for the last few years has been around 60 people. Last year, everyone got tenure. The year before, there was one denial. The year before that, there were two.
Yeah. I think it's important that you get the right denominator, because we've talked about this before. We hire a lot more people in a cohort than 60 who come up for tenure. So many people leave early. So it's your decisions during the career you will make would be, I'm leaving early, it's not what I want to do, or you're not renewed at the time of reappointment, then those people are excluded from that denominator that we just gave you. Then it's the 60 people who've actually made it through in a cohort of 85 or 90. So there, it depends on how you calculate the success rate.
Can you speak to the other denominator then, in terms of people who are entered on tenure track and end up getting tenure?
I think that's what I just did. It's that you enter it with about 90, let's say average cohorts of about 90, and about 60 come up for tenure, and probably 55 to 60 get it in any given year. In fact, I don't think we've had more than two or three denials.
We've never had more than
two. So it's if you've gotten to the point of submitting your dossier, we're pretty confident in, and your department is confident in you. And it shouldn't be the first time you get a negative review, but if you've had negative reviews and you're still going ahead with submitting your dossier, you're more likely to be among that very elite group who don't get it.
Yes. From the same university? Yes. So the question is, can one have more than one external from the same university? You could. I think it's not necessarily desirable. But if your field is such that one university has, you know, many experts, there's nothing to say you can't do that. I would, on the whole, I think I would avoid it if you can, but it's not excluded. Yeah.
Does the similar outcome apply for early tenure candidate considerations?
Similar outcome? Okay.
As far as
there are very few in either the denominator.
Yeah.
It's really hard to...
No. But there's something very important to say about early tenure. If you are not successful with early tenure, you have another shot. That is to say, you go up again in your mandatory year. And the committee the second time round doesn't know, unless you tell them, doesn't know that you've tried before. Please do not take this as a message to do early tenure as a practice run, because it is just as time consuming and just as stressful. But the fact is, you do get another chance. So and what tends to happen, most early tenure cases are in fact successful. But sometimes an early tenure case, when it gets to the DTC, the department will look at it very carefully and say, look, we think it'd be a good idea if you withdrew at this point and try again later, you know, try again in a subsequent year. So you may get helpful feedback along the way from your committee so that you don't come all the way through and then get told no. Yeah.
I promise I'll look at the frequently asked questions. But could you give more of a red line between common interest in a subfield and conflict of interest about a subfield? So, for instance, is it ever the case that a former instructor could be a reviewer, or does it become the case that, say, after 10 years that becomes possible? Or, while you said that participation in a conference together is not a problem, is it always the case that participation on a grant application for a conference is a problem, or does one have to be a co-host of the... Are there red lines, or is this something that one should use once?
So it's a bit fuzzy. Please look at the frequently asked questions, because I've got lots of examples of them. So cases where you're right, it's not always possible to determine what is a conflict of interest. And I think, rather than try and answer the question, I refer you to the frequently asked questions, and also just email us and we will give you an assessment. But the one you asked about, a former instructor, so, you know, we've had people saying, I was taught one course by so-and-so 10 years ago. Is that okay? Yes, that's okay. I was supervised by so-and-so. That's not okay. So it is, some of them are judgment calls, yeah. Yes.
What role does the faculty play?
Your faculty, well, in fact, I see I didn't put it here, but the University Tenure Committee includes your dean and, is it two members from the faculty or three? And then two plus the dean. So three from your faculty. And then the secretariat adds to the UTC three members drawn from other faculties at McGill. So your faculty is playing, a very important role after your DTC has made its recommendations. Well, perhaps we should let Laura present, and then if there are more questions, we can take more afterwards.
Hi. So as you can tell, I'm Laura Weiner, the Director of Teaching and Learning Services, and I just wanted to talk to you very quickly about the teaching portfolio, which is mentioned in the same regulations that Lydia has referred to. And it's really to provide a record of the candidate's teaching. And we recommend including graduate and professional supervision as appropriate in the teaching component. We really see graduate supervision as part of your teaching mandate. And there are guidelines, there are two pages of guidelines for the portfolio. But this is really to summarize what it is. A, concise, that's really key. People don't want to read, bricks like that, and it takes more time to write something shorter. So obviously, as Lydia said, the best advice is to start early. And what you want to be documenting is how effective you are as a teacher, what's the range of content areas and levels that you've taught, and the complexity of the kind of teaching you've done. And finally, the individuality. In other words, what makes me different as a teacher from somebody else who might teach that same course? And this is kind of parallel to we do a lot of these kinds of sessions for graduate students who are going out to interview for jobs, and we're saying what you're trying to do is saying, why should you hire me? What will I be like as a teacher in your department? So you're trying to reflect here what kind of contribution you've been making that's different from what somebody else would have made. And obviously you want to show the progression. You've got 5 years of experience here. Nobody expects that you're going to start off as a star and stay there. But everybody's going to have bumps along the way, and a bump along the way will not in and of itself be detrimental. You show how that has informed your teaching and how you've progressed since then. So the structure of it is really, it's quite short, which makes it very challenging to write, of course, because we all know that that's harder. The body of it would be maximum of 10 pages. The teaching approach, you'll also hear that referred to as a teaching philosophy or a teaching statement, would be maximum 2 pages. Summarize the responsibilities, provide evidence, and if applicable, what kind of educational leadership you've demonstrated and what kind of teaching development activities you've undergone. And the appendices, which are 10 pages maximum, the point here is that it should only be documents that you have referred to in the body of the text of the previous 10 pages. This is not the time to start throwing in things that you think are nice to have. They're really very explicit supporting materials. The teaching approach is the area that most people find the most challenging, especially for people I know from sciences and medicine, engineering, who are not perhaps as used to writing reflective thought pieces as people in arts and humanities and social sciences. But here, what you're trying to demonstrate is that you're intentional about how you teach. that you've thought about it and that you have a rationale for teaching the way you do. And also, more and more, how are you assessing the learning? How are you ensuring that your students are actually learning? Just because you taught it doesn't mean that they learned it. So what we really want to see is evidence of effective teaching, so evidence that the students have learned. So for the responsibilities, you can do this in a table with the courses that you've taught, the level of the course, the enrollment, the format. Was it a lab course? Was it a seminar course? Was it a lecture? Was it a field course? For those of you in clinical areas, clinical teaching. And in these, clinical teaching really often requires some kind of explanation, because that context can be very, very different if you're getting med students one-on-one for 2 weeks, or are you working with somebody very closely over a much longer period. If you've developed a new course, that's something that you would really want to highlight and provide the rationale. Why was that course developed? Why was it needed? What place was it occupying within the curriculum? And here also supervision. And don't forget undergraduate supervision. In many, many faculties, there are really quite active programs of undergraduate research and undergraduate supervising undergraduate projects or theses, and that's part of it as well. Graduate supervision is the most obvious. And if you have postdocs in your lab or in your area, how have you worked with them in a teaching role? For evidence of effectiveness, the course evaluations are the starting point. You're required to give the results for the four core questions. And there are lots of guidelines on the TLS site about how you can report those. There's sample. We have Excel files. You plug in your numbers. It produces nice tables for you. And we're really trying to make that as easy as possible. So you want to be giving the numerical ratings. And you also want to talk a little bit about the measures that you've taken in response to feedback that you've received. So somebody might say, I got comments that the feedback I was giving, I wasn't giving students enough feedback. I therefore developed a process by which every week I would hold up, sample papers and give feedback to the class as a whole that they could infer. It doesn't matter what it is, but you're saying, I took the feedback from the students, I acted upon it, and this is how we see that now my ratings on a question about feedback are very high. You also, for the supervision, can you talk about how effective it was? Are the students you supervised, have they gone on from undergraduate to good master's or doctoral programs? Have your master's students gone on? Have your doctoral students obtained either positions or postdocs? You want to show not only that you've that they were working with you, but that presumably they've succeeded in part because of your contribution. You can include one intact set of students' written comments. In other words, you can't cherry pick here. There can sometimes be formal recognition of teaching accomplishments. You may have gotten a teaching award from your department, from the student association in your department. Sometimes they give them. You can have, in some departments, they do have more formal process of peer mentoring for teaching, so you may have a colleague who has come in and observed your teaching. If people have sent in letters, it's 3 years later and you change, I realize that you've changed my life and I'm now going on to study X, Y, and Z because I fell in love with it in your class. And also, if you've been invited to teach in other places, this can be, I was invited to go in and teach in this course in this other department, in this other university. Presumably, that's an evidence that you have some stature in the community if you're being invited to go in and do these kinds of guest teaching. And finally, for the teaching development and educational leadership, what kinds of efforts have you made to grow as a teacher? Have you been participating in initiatives within your faculty, within your department? Have you participated in workshops and other programs that are offered by TLS? Have you sought out a mentor within your department to work with you as a teacher? Have you been participating in teaching committees? and curriculum committees within it's teaching in the very broad sense of conceptualizing what do you want the curriculum to be like for the students for that program. So if you've been working actively in your department on curriculum committees, that's part of teaching. Now, this could be, as Lydia said, something that you might want to put into service if you felt that that's what you needed, but it certainly can be put into teaching. Did you work on teaching, developing policies around assessment, around other things like that? And these don't have to be university-wide policies. Sometimes departments have policies, well, guidelines on how they want to do things. And have you published anything on your teaching? More and more, there's the area known as the scholarship of teaching and learning, where professors are publishing scholarly articles related to aspects of their teaching. Almost every discipline has a journal of blank education, and many of those journals accept really interesting articles. They're good places to go and look for ideas about teaching if you want to be developing your own teaching. So those kinds of publications, where they won't count necessarily in your research area, because if you're a chemist, then education wouldn't necessarily count for that. But if you've published in the Journal of Chemical Education a piece that is talking about a teaching development or some kind of enhancement you've made or some kind of results of some research, that would count in your teaching development section. So gathering evidence, Lydia, I can't emphasize enough what Lydia said about you can't start too early. I know at least one person said that they were not going up for tenure in this cohort, so that's great. Create a shoebox, either a real shoebox or a virtual shoebox. Make sure you have a list of every student you've supervised. Course evaluations now are really easy at McGill because they're all online, which is great. So you don't have to file them away, but you want to make sure you have a list of the courses that you taught so you can go back and get the evaluations. What committees were you on? What programs did you help develop? I redesigned this course. I gave this presentation. If you haven't already started doing that, go home and start doing that now, because it is really, really hard to recreate those events that you thought were unforgettable. 6 months later, you've forgotten them. And the other thing I wanted to say is that we, at Teaching and Learning Services, we provide individual consultations throughout your career here on anything to do with teaching. If you have questions about your courses, about designing your courses, about assessment, about new strategies, new ideas, we're always very happy to meet with people one-on-one. We also do provide a consultation service on the development, and we'll provide feedback on your teaching portfolio. Do not call the last week of August for a September 1st deadline. Every year we get at least one person, and it's really hard. We get a lot of people who will contact us May and June for a first. They've got maybe a real sketch, can provide feedback. Then, mid-August, they'll send, this is the revised draft. That's reasonable. But please don't call us on August 26th and say, my dossier is due September 1st. Can't somebody please meet with me? Because it's really hard. We cannot. It's a little late at that point. We do also have, every year we write to the professors who just got tenure and say, congratulations, you just got tenure. Would you be willing to share your teaching portfolio and make it available for other people just at McGill who are going to be going up for tenure in the years to come? So we have a lot of very recent examples of teaching portfolios, and I think we now have in all of the, at least from all of the faculties. So those are available for consultation on site at our offices, which are in the ground floor of the McLennan Library Building. You're welcome to come down and look at those. It can just give you an idea of what does this mean. Any questions that you have, all you have to remember is tls@mcgill.ca. That will get to us about any questions to do with teaching, and certainly specifically with relation to the teaching portfolio. So, questions? Yes, Aliki.
But I wonder if you could comment on sort of a the serious issue of the response rates that we get. So the stakes are pretty high for us, but in many courses, as we know, we discussed it before, you know, 20%, 30%, 16% response rate. So you're really just getting such a small sample, even though we tell students the stakes are really high for us, not just for tenure promotions, but also for improvement in teaching. But ultimately, at the end of the day, consistently over 5 years, we're getting 20, 30% response rate.
The question is about the response rate for course evaluations. Over the university, our rate is 49%. The average response rate is 49%. So there's tremendous variation in response rates. And we've tried to look even within departments, there is tremendous response rate, variation in response rates. We're working very hard with the students to increase that. One of the things that we've done a lot of analysis on, though, is how reliable is the sample, right? Is there sample bias, even if it's a very, what looks to you like a very small sample? The thresholds that we have for dissemination, in other words, it goes from 25% for the largest classes to 40% for the smallest classes. If you meet those dissemination thresholds, those are reliable. Even they don't feel, I know professors all the time saying, but I only heard from 35%. Well, 35% of 200 students is a lot. And we have done analyses every which way, and there's no evidence of any systematic bias of the students who respond versus the students who don't respond. So all I can say is that we're working very hard to increase the response rates. Assistant professors tend to have the highest response rates, and we guess that's because they're probably most effective at communicating that they're important. We have a very eager bunch of students this year that we're working with to try and get that. So we have a lot of strategies listed also on our website on the course evaluations for things that you can do to help encourage students to respond. So I can encourage you to do that as well. Yes?
What if the numbers in your department, student numbers, are traditionally always been low, right? So you're teaching classes 10, 15, 5, and even the survey courses don't have more than 17 to 16 people. So eventually you've got the 10-year numbers, 10 to 16.
If the question is about if you're, it's not a question that I get very often of the problem of teaching only small classes. That's not, I don't think I've ever actually had that question before. But if you're in a department where all of the courses are small, that's going to come through. It's going to be representative. The departmental tenure committee is certainly going to recognize that you've been teaching a cross-section of courses within your department. You're not picking and choosing just the small courses. So I don't know, but I don't see that would be a particular, most people would envy you that problem. Are there any other questions? Yes?
So I'm getting a little bit of a mixed message regarding where to put graduate supervision in my dossier. Mm-hmm. It was a little bit thought about, I can balance, my research or my teaching portfolio, and you tell me I should put it in the teaching. Are there clear guidelines, or are there...
You want to
say
this one?
Well, I think the important thing is that it's up to you to make the best case for your own tenure. So that's why we say decide. What Laura is saying, I think you could think of it as qualitative and quantitative, right? If you've published with your graduate students, then that's going in your publication record, right? It's clear. If you're supervising graduate students, the number of students you've supervised is part of your teaching dossier. So, and that's not double counting, because you're saying, this is the number of students I've supervised, and here there's master's and PhD students. And in my research dossier, you'll see that I also publish with my students. That's a positive comment on your work.
Sometimes people will talk also about how they set up their weekly lab meetings with all of their graduate students, and they have journal clubs, or they structure those meetings to be very much an educational process for their grad students. So that would come in under the teaching component. Is there any other questions?
Just
So I'll turn it back over. Tony, do you want to read it? Oh, I'm sorry. They will be. They will be. With the graduate students, you mean? Well, if you're teaching a course, you're talking about just the supervision aspect. You can have letters from former students. So those can be solicited, and they can be very powerful, actually, letters from former students. Obviously, not current ones for obvious reasons, but. Yes? I would say it depends. Is that a one-off thing? Somebody stopped by your office and you had it can be a very profound talk, you know, two-hour talk about career advice and or help, but it was a one-off thing rather than something that's a prolonged relationship. I think I'm getting pushed.
Yeah,
I'm going to let you guys.
Mentorship can also count as service. Yeah, if you have a structured mentorship program in your department and you're an active participant, if you have signed up with the university to be a mentor for an undergraduate student, that's a formal participation, and it can be part of the service you, not in your department, maybe not even in your discipline, but you're rendering a service to the university, and therefore you can count it in your service dossier.
Any other questions? So, I think it's still you want to.
So thank you to all of our presenters this afternoon, and thank you to all of you for being here. I hope you found it helpful, and the information doesn't necessarily end at the end of the session. Again, a reminder that this will be, the recording of today's session will be archived online. There is a second tenure information session at the McDonald campus coming up in January. And at any time, if you have questions or you'd like to find out more about interpretations of regulations or how the regulations are actually applied in practice, don't hesitate to contact either Professor White or the Secretariat, and we'll do our best to give you an answer or to find someone who can answer your question.
Read the frequently asked questions,
and also read the regulations. As you won't be surprised to know that you can read them through five times, and each time develop a slightly different appreciation of some of the nuances. So, thank you again for being here, and all the best in your. In your tenure efforts.